I'd like for us to turn over to Luke 14 to start this message. And with it, Luke 14 is often the scripture that we turn to in baptism. And it involves counting the cost. We agree when we surrender to God at baptism that we want to live His way of life and that our lives no longer belong just to us, that we are to use them in service to God. It means understanding what the cost is, counting the cost. At one point it says in verse 26, if any man comes to me, some translations have this rendered correctly, love not less his father, mother, father, children, wives, brethren, sisters, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever does not bear his cross and comes after me cannot be my disciple. And it involves us being committed in a way where we are like soldiers, that we have to sometimes fight for our beliefs and to fight against the elements of society that could so easily beset us, so easily entangle us. Fortunately, that has not happened, or else we wouldn't be here. But still, we don't want to fall prey to that. We're to be good soldiers in that respect. With that theme in mind, let's go over to verse 28. For which of you, intending to build a tower, sits not down first and counts the cost, whether he has enough money to finish it? I remember one time somebody in our hometown had constructed this large foundation and simply ran out of money. It was such a waste to be able to just go that far and then to fold it up. As far as I know, it still sits there empty to this day. Thousands and thousands of dollars that was wasted. It's an enigma to anybody that is to go by and to see that. Verse 30, such as those saying, well, this man began to build, but he was not able to finish it. And notice this, what king going to make war with another king does not sit down first and consult with advisors whether he be able with 10,000 to successfully battle the one king that has 20,000? Or else when the other is far away off, he sends an ambassador and desires conditions of peace. Likewise, verse 33, whosoever be of you that forsakes not all that he says, he cannot be my disciple. Counting the cost is certainly important, and being an active Christian, being vigilant, being alert, and so many of those traits are the traits of soldiers. And so we can see over in 2 Timothy chapter 2, what Paul said not just to Timothy, but to the churches. And that is that we're not just going through the motions and floating along. Let's start in verse 1, actually, in 2 Timothy 2. You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things that you have heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit you to faithful men that they will be able to teach others. You therefore endure hardness or trial or the challenge of keeping on, perseverance, as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that wars entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he might please him who has chosen him to be a soldier. That's where we find ourselves. And soldiers, if they are engaged in battle, they count the cost. Generals count the cost. Lieutenants, colonels, all others in an army, they are going to evaluate constantly to see whether they can go against an enemy, and they have to account whether the enemy has greater odds of winning than they do or not. What we understand is, and even we stress this at the camp with prayer study, fasting, and meditation, that we have to resort to important tools in order to fight the enemy, which is Satan, and also ourselves and society. Not that every minute is a battle, but we are soldiers. We're soldiers of Christ. We have songs in the hymnal that we sing. I definitely will never forget the first time I went to church, and I had studied military and service and war, and I had thought that, well, the church supports conscientious objector status. And I was mind-boggled by the choice of hymns. It was Onward Christian Soldiers was one, okay. And then there was the Will I Love, O Lord, and the forces will be thrown into the Red Sea. And then we had another hymn, and it was something else on war. And I thought, these guys are hawks. They're not doves. They're really feisty. And then when Mr. Kellers happened to be there, and he said, okay, how many of you seen Tora, 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 this movie about in World War II? And then he says, and also this other one that's really enlightening, that's on Patton by George Scott. That's like, and then we sing another war hymn after that. And I thought, wow, these guys are really up for battles. They are. I see babies, you know, on blankets around, and a lot of people that seem to be quiet. But don't let that fool you. These guys are, you know, they're for war. Well, they were for spiritual warfare because they know that you can't survive without it. So considering this in mind, you never want to be in a case where you're outgunned or outmanned. You always want God to be behind you in order to help you in your soldiering. None of us want to go into situations where the enemy has 20,000, we have 10, you know, by comparison, 10,000, whether it's men or weapons or whatever. We don't want to be in a disadvantage. And yet, of and by ourselves, we can do nothing. That's what Christ said. Without me, you can do nothing, John 15:5. And so it is that we really need his help to accomplish anything of any significance. Let me illustrate this in a way that I think you'll never forget. The need to have sufficient force to deal with the challenges and the problems that we face. This year is the 20th anniversary of an incredible event. Let me preface this by asking, first of all, how many have ever heard of Bonnie and Clyde? So you know they were notorious bank robbers in the Depression years, wreaking havoc in the Midwest. Let me read about excerpts of an article entitled L.A., that's Los Angeles, Gunfight Ignites Debate Over Media, Police, and Firepower. This is from the Christian Science Monitor of March of 1997, just a few days after the biggest shootout that ever happened in the United States. North Hollywood, California. It says a wild street shootout between Los Angeles police and automatic weapons-wielding bank robbers has opened a new chapter of self-examination for law enforcement officers in America's second-largest city. The initial outgunning of the police during Friday morning's gunfight was played out in vivid color on live television. At the height of the crisis, several officers had to resort to the arsenal of a nearby gun store to commandeer 9 rifles with enough firepower to pierce their assailants' protective clothing. How that started is, to me, fascinating. Two people met. It wasn't Bonnie and Clyde. I don't know if anybody here has ever heard of Larry Phillips and Emil Medesoraniu, who was from Romania. But those people had been on the wrong side of the law for a number of years in the 1990s, and they became good friends. And they decided that they would try to live life in the fast lane and steal a lot of money to make life more interesting. On one occasion, they, in 1993, they were outside of Littleton, Colorado, and they saw an armored truck at a bank with money being placed in it. And they just took the truck over and made off with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars and never were caught. About 6 months later, they were arrested for speeding in California, and officers confiscated 2 handguns, 2 semi-automatic rifles, a radio scanner, smoke bombs, improvised explosive devices, body armor, and 3 different sets of California license plates. Bad dudes. They should have realized this was probably a manifestation of something even deeper and worse, that these people were potential menaces to society. But they let them go. 100 days in jail. And that was it. June 14th, 1995, they ambushed another armored car, this time killing one guard, seriously wounding the other. Most people would have stopped there. But in May of 1996, about 11 months later, they robbed not one but two Bank of Americas in the San Fernando Valley, stealing $1.5 million. By now, they had accumulated well over $2 million. Maybe it's not a surprise to some that they decided to keep on going. February 28, 1997 was going to be the red letter day in which these two same robbers were to converge on the Bank of America in North Hollywood, California. They had anticipated and planned the entire thing. They were going to move in, capture all of the employees, fire guns into the ceiling to get their attention quickly. They figured they had 8 minutes. They would wear ski masks, be fully clothed, and have watches on their wrists that were set for 8 minutes. And they could see how much time was left all the way through. They would put all the people in the vault. They would take what they thought was $750,000 and then make good their escape through their getaway car in the back. What they did not anticipate was that on random police patrol, one cruiser would go by that bank and notice just that things looked a little eerie, with no human traffic in front, which was unusual for a Friday morning, and that maybe something was up and that it might not be a bad idea to turn into the driveway and see. At that point, when the two officers decided to do that, the bank robbers fired their guns in the ceiling. People screamed. They hurried them off to the vault and then grabbed all these sacks of money that they knew would be available. They had been casing this area for several months. They knew the pattern, the routine. Everything was clockwork until the police showed. And so then they fought their way out of the building and shot at these people. And then the police called in for backup. They didn't understand the enemy. They didn't understand that these two people, just two of them, had more firepower than they would ever dream of. And so they were calling six other police in, and then it was 20 in the next few minutes, and they'd get out of their cars and they'd pull out their pistols. Bang, bang. As it was pointed out later, their weapons were not that accurate. And sometimes with pistols you have a kickback. They weren't very accurate for any distance at all. When they would shoot, bang, bang, these two guys would pop up with AK-47s and Uzi machine guns. And that was not even a contest. So they kept calling in for more backup. And shots were ringing out everywhere. Pretty soon, there were seven bystanders that were wounded. One girl was at the ATM, and then when she ran for cover, the next thing she knew, she was landing on her chest on the pavement, and she had been shot in the foot. Bullets flying all over. These two characters had over 1,500 rounds of ammunition. They were just spraying bullets. And now there were 100 police on the scene, and they were shooting, some of them, at point-blank range, and you can see this on the Internet, too, if you have nothing else to do tonight. They would be at point-blank range shooting at these bad guys, and the bullets were bouncing off of them. One guy had 40 pounds of armor on, and it was like, go ahead, make my day. And he was just walking along calmly as they got their keys, and they were going to get into the vehicle. Then some of the people, as was mentioned in this article, got frustrated. They ran over to a nearby gun shop, busted in, and said, give us your weapons. You've got more than what we have. You've got machine guns that we don't have. And so they grabbed them and continued. Now there were 300 Los Angeles police on the scene, being held at bay by these two guys. Eventually, they got weaponry that could pierce the armor. And eventually the two were killed. Amazingly, no police were killed, but nine were wounded. And seven bystanders wounded. Everybody survived except the bank robbers. But you talk about going up against an enemy that when you don't have the firepower, you don't have what you need, and to be retaliated like they were is an awful situation. One of the leading officers said, that particular day, I was at the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong gun. I didn't have the weapon I needed. Eventually, he got it. Steal it from a gun store. Well, they made amends there later. But this was a desperate situation. It points out the need that when you have to engage in battle, you need backup. Going into these prisons that I mentioned about earlier in the announcements, going into the prisons is reasonably safe activity because there are plenty of guards around. You're given a body alarm. Like one person said, you know, use your body alarm and we'll try to come get you. Try, if we can. Prisoners tell me all the different stories, the chaos that goes on in these places, the stabbings. Everybody has seen stabbings, knifings, and people get carried off to the hospital and others that die. It's the law of the jungle in many of these places. In fact, guards sometimes are on the take, and that makes it possible you can buy anything you want in prison if you have enough money. No, not anything. Yeah, anything you want. It gets in there. A cell phone that sells for $30 at Walmart's worth $600 in prison because people that are drug lords, head of gangs, that are incarcerated, they'll pay $600 for a device that keeps them connected to the outside world that can direct what's going on. You've got every gang of men in there. And the prisoners themselves know that they, if they're going to stand out, which they do, and they're hassled by other religious people, quote unquote, that have other beliefs. They've got every religion imaginable. The chaplain on the board says, okay, we have something for the Islam, we've got something for the JWs, we got something for the Catholics, something for the Jews, something for the Messianics, something for you guys, and to keep it all straight. And a lot of these other groups will persecute each other. They'll persecute Sabbatarians, so on. Anybody that wants to come to our Bible study has to count the cost because there's a lot of spiritual warfare in prison just as there is outside of prison. Even Mr. Armstrong talked about a world held captive. And a lot of times the enemy has more firepower than we do. And that's where we need God. We really have to. We're soldiers in this world. And sometimes we call for backup. One of the classic cases as far as a battle for backup was the Battle of Gettysburg in the Civil War. There were some Union soldiers and some Southern soldiers that were just a few people coming into a store. They all wanted to get some pairs of shoes. And then it was like, oh, there's the enemy. And one shoots at the other, and the other shoots back at the first. And it's a stalemate, so one group of guys calls for backup, and they get some people, so the other one calls for backup. And the understanding was, you can't fight this alone when you're up against great odds. The ironic thing was everybody was called in for backup, and you had this massive battle that was never really planned. Soldier understands that you never know exactly where the next battle is going to be or when it's going to be. We might live a very peaceful afternoon, and something could flare up somewhere else. You never know. I remember January 3rd, 1979, so vividly. Anybody remember what happened that day? State of California took over the Pasadena campus of the church. And I'm driving across the Hillsborough River on 56th Street, and I'm catching the news, and I didn't expect it to be about people that I knew. And says, and now in Pasadena, California, authorities of the state of California have just taken over the Worldwide Church of God into a receivership with alleged allegations of misappropriation of funds, $70 million of misappropriation, which is quite an accomplishment. How do you make that kind of money disappear when you're making payroll every week? It was an erroneous lie, but it doesn't matter. You know, people grab that and run with it. We live in a world of fake news today. There's always been some fake news. And sometimes people are guilty until proven innocent. I'll never forget that day. We were looking for backup. We needed it from God. It was a battle we didn't think we could fight by ourselves. We had some good personnel. We had Ralph Helge, who was our attorney, and his staff, and Mr. Armstrong's staff, and other people. But that was very sobering. And I know that I've lived around enough to see other skirmishes in spiritual battles. And they come in different shapes and sizes. And the seasoned soldier, the one that's close to God, the one that trusts in God in the face of spiritual warfare, is the one that will succeed. Can't emphasize that enough. When we were in 2 Timothy 2, I'm going to go back there, but I want to read and stress verse 4 of 2 Timothy 2. No man or woman that wars entangles himself with the affairs of this life that he might please him that has chosen him to be a soldier. Now, we have affairs in this life, but they're not our primary obsession. We seek first the kingdom of God and the other things that we need, maybe some wants and other desires and dreams and hopes can be added to us. But God comes first. And a relationship that's strong enough to withstand the spiritual battles that we face. People that get entangled with society get unfocused. And when they're more involved with other elements of society than they are with God, then they're in trouble. They're vulnerable. And one of the things about spiritual warfare, as I think we all know, you can't let down. You've got to be vigilant all the time. Being zealous and vigilant in 1979 is not a recipe or guarantee that you will be in 2017. We take it one day at a time, one year at a time. You've done that enough because you're here. But we have to continue to do that. Indication is from the Great Tribulation prophecies that we will have greater challenges in the future than we did in the past. That involved a lot of spiritual warfare, even if we wanted to be conscientious objectors. Look, I'm just not going to be involved. My brethren can fight wars, but I'm just going to be a little hermit and sit at home for the next 10 years. That's not spiritual growth. Those people can be very vulnerable. If you've ever studied history, could be any so much in history with warfare, people have been forced to take sides. And the only side that really is valuable is taking God's side and being an instrument in God's hand and fighting the war that he fights. And sometimes we pick our battles. Now, I could easily get involved with other battles in Hillsborough County in Florida and be all in outrage over some city ordinance, you know, that they're going to run a bypass around Temple Terrace, Florida, instead of allowing commerce to come right up Main Street and get all worried about what that's going to do for business and how we need to marshal support and reach all the neighbors and get up in arms about this and fight this battle. Well, that would be the wrong battle. That could consume all my time and energy when I have to be concerned about spiritual warfare just as you do. In the prisons also, there's another statement that said, very interesting. There's different slogans around. I think it's to the personnel that work there. Whenever we go to the prisons, there's always a sign in front of all of them, now hiring. You know, they can never keep the people because some of the activity is kind of grisly, not for the faint of heart. And so, yes, they're hiring. And there are different slogans throughout the prison that will have a picture of a guard, and it says, We have each other's back. We're there for each other. You know, we're a team. And that's a good concept. And in the church, we are a team. Sometimes we can share what we're going through as far as different trials and battles, and we can pray for each other. You know, you're asking for backup, and you're asking from a great resource, other brethren. And that's important. But being vigilant all the time. I can remember walking through a graveyard in Marietta, Georgia, right after the Battle of Kennesaw. A number of the soldiers were buried in North Marietta. And I came across one tombstone. It was really amazing to me. It had, you know, John Doe. And above his name, it said, fought at Bull Run. fought at Antietam, fought at Antioch, Shiloh, fought at the Battle of Chickamauga, enlisted like 7 or 8 battles, and then died at Kennesaw. Was he as vigilant at Kennesaw as he was at Bull Run? I don't know. But it's possible for people to go through battle fatigue, and they were up for the first skirmish and up for the second, but were they able to sustain focus and vigilance? A lot of people don't. A lot of people, especially in the Korean War, we never had lost a war. The United States had never lost a war, really, up until that time. That became a stalemate. And a number of the American POWs were extremely discouraged, despondent. They didn't have enough of a purpose. Why are we here? Why am I on the 38th parallel fighting Asian people that I had never even seen before? When they were captured, many of them gave up and were very despondent. Some of the captains that wrote about this later said, I would do anything I could to stir up my men. I would laugh at them, I'd kick them, I would insult them, I'd get in their face and scream at them. And if they were still phlegmatic and non-expressive, I knew I'd lost them. I knew they'd be dead in a few weeks. If they didn't have any fight left, that they saw no purpose. Christians can't ever be a spiritual deficit like that. We always have hope, the hope that lies within us, that we're always moving forward, taking new ground, seeking the kingdom of God, marching forward. That's a challenge. There are a lot of distractions. Different crises will come. And some people say, oh, if we have another trial like the last one, I don't know. The better answer is, if we have other challenges in the long run, it won't matter, because I'm calling for backup. I'm not going to do this on my own. Christ said I couldn't do it on my own. I want to do my part. I want to be vigilant as if it all depended on me, but I want God behind it. I want backup. I want spiritual backup. I need help. And if I can draw some additional help from other brethren, their prayers, their support, their encouragement, and the encouragement from coming here, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. I don't know what it's like here. I don't think it's an issue here. But I know in Tampa, I know in other places in Florida, there'll be some people that are getting nonchalant about it. And you could get asleep at the switch here. There's never a time to take a spiritual vacation. Always have to be praying every day and being alert. To not pray and study is to walk around like a soldier leaving his rifle at home. You have to invest that kind of time. I'm preaching to the choir, in a sense. I know that you know this. You've heard this for a long time. The value of a message or a goal of a message to me is to not say something new about something new, because that gets you into heresy and speculation and all. But say something new about something old. To see things in maybe a different angle, a different way. Say, yeah, that really makes sense. Everything that I've been doing in the church for all these years, it makes more sense now than it did ever. Looking for backup. When David killed Goliath, David went to Saul and says, you know, I can take this giant. You know, God delivered me from the paw of the lion. He delivered me from the paw of the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine, you know, I can do that. He said that the key was that God would be the one that made the difference. I'll turn over there. You know, we work as if it all depends on us, and you've heard that. And then we pray and we trust in God as if it all depends on him, because it really does. 1 Samuel 17 is the area in which David kills Goliath. And he was very confident, but it was confidence in God. In chapter 17, verse 46, this day will the Lord deliver you into my hand. That's what David said. He didn't say, this day, because I'm just so good with a slingshot, I'm going to take down you, Goliath. He didn't take any personal credit. He worked, he did his part, but he trusted in God. And in verse 47, and all this assembly shall know that the Lord saves not with the sword or with spear, for the battle is the Lord's. That's right. We are participants, But God is our backup, and only with God's help will we ever succeed. It is a work to finish an end-time witness. Without God, we can't do it on our own. We can have super intelligent people with great ideas and all the money in the world, and it won't happen. Over in Exodus 14, the time when the Israelites crossed the Red Sea, let's never forget, verse 13. And Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." Well, up until they stood still, they had to come together as a nation. They had to march out of Egypt. They followed the instruction of the Passover. They had the night to be observed. They painted the blood on the door jamb. They interfaced with the Egyptians, actually received a lot of spoil from the people that lived there. They were active, but when it came down to looking for victory, God had to make the difference. But they did their part. They were good soldiers at that point. It's one of the few times in the history of ancient Israel that the Israelites all did what they were asked to do simultaneously. If we seem overwhelmed, we have to do what David did, what Moses did. Look to God for backup. Look to God to have what it takes to get us over the hump, to get us over the hill. We know that, but what is ironic is sometimes we can say, I believe in backup. I believe in spiritual backup because I think that prayer is a nice idea. I think that studying the Bible is helpful. Now, don't ask me how often I do that, but I think it's a great idea. I mean, I could see myself doing this all the time if I didn't have this to take care of and that to take care of and so on. And so maybe I'll do it a little bit. Back at the turn of the last century in Ireland, there was a little town where electricity was finally brought into the town. And this one woman was the first to receive it. And then a few weeks later, everybody else would. It was going to be this big, huge boon for the town. It would enable the people to do so much more than what they could do with kerosene lamps. She was given some electric lights. She was the first one to have electricity in her town. A few weeks later, the news reporter interviewed her and says, "Well, what's it like having electricity? Apparently, you can do so much more in the evening. You can actually run an ice box and have lights in other rooms, and people can do so much more. So what's it been like having electricity?" She says, "Well, I really like electricity because I'll turn all the lights on when it's dark to find out where the kerosene lamps are. And then I light all the kerosene lamps and I turn the electricity off." They were surprised. They didn't expect that. And her situation was, she understood there was some value to it, but she underrated it. If we can't be so familiar with contact with God and prayer and study being kind of a pesky obligation we have to get out of the way before we do anything else, it's not the response that, of course, God would want us to have. And so it's important. People do better. Soldiers do better. Christians do better when they anticipate what's going to happen. You know, tomorrow, there's no telling what could happen. I could have an accident, or I could have somebody call me and insult me and get me angered, or this could happen, or whatever it is. Or there could be some complaint about my church, whatever, that I have to anticipate. Can't let these things hit me by surprise, especially a soldier. Can't let that sneak up and hit me by surprise. I like one comment that was made by one observer studying warfare. He says, "The reason why many people fail in battle is that they wait until the hour of battle. The reason why others succeed is because they've gained their victories on their knees long before the battle came. Anticipate your battles, fight them on your knees before temptation comes, and you shall always have victory." Well, our enemy is not just on the outside. We can be our own worst enemies. Doesn't have to be that way, but we can. We can fight against God or what God's laws dictate that we do. If we don't, we're not fighting the fight of a good soldier. Paul was very candid, and I find this encouraging, in Romans chapter 7. We can read about human nature. I used to think before I came into God's church that human nature was naturally good, that we naturally wanted to always do the right things, that we naturally always had the right thoughts, and I was deceived on that. In Romans chapter 8 and verse 7, it says, "Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can it be." That's a strong indictment. And Paul talks about himself in Romans 7. He says in verse 15, "For which that which I do I allow not, and for what I would, that I don't do, but what I hate, that I do." You might think, if you never read this or read the Bible, wow, that Apostle Paul, he does what he wouldn't do, and then the things that are bad, he does. He must be some evil, wicked person. And he wasn't, not after conversion. But he was so sensitive to his shortcomings that when he made a little mistake, that really bothered him. And in the Christian's life, our lives are like the window shade that goes up. We see a little more of our own vanity or own human nature, and that window shade slides up higher, and we go, oh no. We examine ourselves. We're told to before Passover, and we find out that we're maybe not as good a soldier as we thought we were, or we see how much more we can improve in. And that's a lifelong quest. But Romans 7, verse 15, he says, that I hate, I do that. I don't think he did that more than other people, but in his mind, with his sensitivity, because he had spiritually grown, that's the way it seemed to him. "If I then do that which I wouldn't, I consent unto the law that it is good. Now then, it is no more I that do it, but the sin that dwells in me. For I know, that is, in my flesh dwells no good thing. For, you know, I know what to do, to will is present with me, but how to perform it, I don't know. I don't find it. For the good that I would, I do not. And the evil that I would not, that I do. Now if I do that which I wouldn't, it is no more I that do it, but the sin that dwells in me. I then find a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me." And so forth. And he even calls himself, verse 24, "O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord." So he saying that basically he was an enemy to himself. We have to fight ourselves. If we had the time, we could go to 1 Corinthians 6, verses 9 and 10, where it says, you know, talking about brethren, does it know these people will not enter the kingdom of God, those that live for strife, drunkards or fornicators, or there's a laundry list. It's, you know, quite lengthy. And it says, "And such were some of you." To me, I read that, and I read Romans 7, and I find it encouraging that a mighty servant of God knew that he had shortcomings. And so if he made it with flying colors, then if we could walk in his steps and do the things he encouraged, and then we could be victorious soldiers. What would perhaps discourage me is if Paul and other men and women of the Bible said, "I lived a perfect life and it was easy, and I didn't have any bad thoughts, and I just, you know, rolled with life, and I just did everything so well, and it was just easy, and I know a crown of righteousness is laid up in heaven." Well, I would think, well, where does that leave the rest of us? I can remember asking one minister one time, "Well, do you ever, when do you get to the point where you never have a bad thought?" And the answer was, "Oh, about 3 days after you're in the grave, you know, then it kicks in, you know." Otherwise, we still have to fight. We still have to fight. And one of the saddest things is to meet people that don't want to anymore. And that sometimes happens in actual battles where people say, "Ah, forget it." And they'll walk out with the bullets flying and they say, I'm done. You know, I'm stop the world. I want to get off. And then they get killed. There is no substitute for victory. There just is none. Abraham Lincoln made the statement in a diary during the worst part of the Civil War. He said, quote, "Without Christ, I cannot succeed. But he said, with Christ, I cannot fail. He was a unique individual that was yet president at a very critical time because he trusted in God. And a lot of that was made possible by the upbringing of his mom. He didn't really have a dad, but he said, my mother was everything, and instilled a deep respect for the Bible and for biblical principles. But we have to fight ourselves. I can remember one man who wrestled with smoking. He wanted to be a fighter, and it was just such a hard thing for him. Human nature is so subtle. And finally, he went a whole month without smoking, and he says, isn't that wonderful? It's been a battle. It's been great. He said, I'm so happy. I want to celebrate by lighting up. Whoa, you can't do that. There was another man who had an obsession with gambling. The biggest thing was to bet a lot of money on when the odds were so far against you. So he said, I like to go for the long shots. Long shots, you know, all against all odds. And to win something big, he says, it's the ultimate adrenaline rush. They said, so how's it been for you? Well, lost my house, lost my family, lost my car, lost my job, lost my health, lost everything. So are you in rehabilitation? Yes. Would you like to have a happy outcome? Yes. What are your odds of having a happy outcome? He says, it's a long shot. He hadn't changed, still thinking wrongly. Well, how about this? I vowed as a diabetic I would never eat a dozen donuts until the doctor said it was okay. And he hasn't said it's okay yet. But as I drove home, I saw this parking place. It just opened up in front of Dunkin' Donuts. And I think it was a sign from heaven. It was God wanted me to have those 12 donuts. But people play games like that. They'll do that. You have to penetrate the defense barrier. You know, we have to think clearly. Our vision has to be 2020, spiritually speaking. We've got to know what's going on. We have to anticipate our battles, too. A lot of times, if you wait until the time of battle, it's too late. In some locker rooms, I remember in our high school, it was in the wing where the football guys were. It says, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Well, that's not true. It's when the going is easy, the tough get going. The going is easy. Most people, it's human nature, will say, well, when the next battle comes, you count me in, I'm going to be right there. But if you don't have the spiritual backup of God, and you don't have 20/20 vision spiritually, and you're not vigilant and alert, it can creep up on you or me or anybody. God's not a respecter of persons. He's not going to say, like to those foolish five virgins, oh, they're not ready yet, but they're with me. They, you know, worship Christ. I feel obligated to bail them out. I'll make a one-time exception. I'm going to bail them out. They just weren't ready. They weren't anticipating. They didn't realize it would be so difficult. Let's go over to Matthew 25. Verse 1, then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened to 10 virgins that took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. 5 wise, 5 foolish. But they all represented people that were converted. And they that were foolish took their lamps and they didn't take any oil with them. In other words, they weren't preparing, they were not anticipating. The wise took oil in their vessels, oil symbolizing God's Holy Spirit. And when the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. Now this made more sense, this parable or this story, to the audience of Christ's day, because our customs are not the same. Back then, wealthy people, if they were going to have a wedding, they sponsored it. They invited maybe hundreds of people, like when Christ turned the water into wine in Cana in John 2. That was probably a wedding of several hundred people minimum. It was common to have huge weddings. They didn't have a lot of entertainment, and this was an exciting time. No internet, no television, none of the things that we have that so easily distract us on many occasions. So they had a wedding. It might be a banquet, be a series of banquet meals if they could afford it. And there would be celebration for a whole week. And the bridegroom, it was understood, he could come claim the bride at any time during that 7-day period. he would not come on the first day of the seven, because the people were in a festive mood and they were getting there and there was food and drink and it was a time to celebrate. Somewhere in that week he could come, and it could be at 3 p.m. or it could be 3 a.m. And everybody, including the five foolish virgins here, knew that it could be at night. And everybody had to be ready. It was like some big joke to surprise the bride-to-be and her bridal party and all. It's 4 a.m. and we're here. We're going to get it started now. And they knew it could be at any time. Just like we know that Christ's turn is imminent, it could be soon coming year or another, or it could be just 10 seconds away. I can walk out of here and get run over by a cement truck on the street, and that's it for me. Am I ready? Or does God think I need more time? Or maybe he thinks I need more time, and I walk out in front of a truck, and that's it? Then what happens? I don't know. I don't want to think about that. We don't want to get that close to the edge. Why would we be foolish when we could be wise? And so the foolish virgins woke up just like the five wise virgins woke up. And the five wise knew what to do. Okay, it's happening. It's now. I fall back on this. I do the other. But the foolish, first thing they had to do was to have oil. How do you do that? You work, you develop a prayer life with God and communicate and make lasting commitment. And they hadn't thought that far. And they were just totally not ready. And that would be like turning an army loose in the woods to fight the enemy, but you're not giving them any weapons. They just have to do it as best they can. That would be a terrible disadvantage in actual literal warfare. But when you don't anticipate and you're not ready, bad things can happen. You look at Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham's nephew, Lot, was not really ready. Angels were dragging him out of the city, and they were taking his family. And Lot's wife was never really convinced, and so her heart was still in Sodom. She looked back, became a pillar of salt. It's always been the minority in the Bible that really, really understood what it was like to be a good soldier and to pay the price, count the cost, and be vigilant, which is an all-the-time thing. The famous football coach Vince Lombardi talked about that. Winning is not an accident. Winning is a habit. And he says, unfortunately, so is losing. You don't win things once in a while. You don't do things right just once in a while if you're very good at them. He said that the right approach to take in any endeavor of life, whether it be in athletics or maybe in business or, more importantly, in spiritual life, is that you do things right all the time. The people that have the best insight are not the ones with the greatest intellect. It's the ones that pray every day and study every day and fast when they need to and meditate when they need to. I was trying to explain meditation to these youth, and some are 12 and 13 years of age, and if you're not careful, you can just go way over their heads with some of these abstract-like concepts. And if you ask them, have you ever meditated, they probably would say, I don't think so, but I'm not sure. But meditation is evaluating and thinking about things, whether they were good or bad, things that have already happened. And the value of meditation is to learn from the past or to think and anticipate, how am I going to handle this? A lot of times allows for introspection in lives to think, well, what could I do better? Abraham's example. It might be really unfair. Why life a hassle? In my purpose, I do everything. The church goes through your purpose of being God's family. And for is who knitted some of the crimes that he had, or had crimes, deeds that he did. Persecution, Acts chapter 7 and 8 and 9. He was the church of God. He became 2 Timothy. In verse 7, or verse 6, for I am now ready to be offered, or to die, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight. It wasn't just a nonchalant fight. He didn't just whip out a sword and say, "Don't bother me." No, he fought a good fight. "I have finished my course. I have kept the faith." Now, that's supreme confidence, but it was with God, not in himself. Verse 8, "Therefore is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous God, at that day, and not to me only, but to all them that love his appearing." So that's a wonderful blessing, that we can have that level of confidence. No matter what we've ever done that we have regrets for, any sins, maybe sins yet to be forgiven because maybe we haven't asked for forgiveness, whatever it is, we can get to that point too where we say, "I have fought the good faith. I have kept the faith. I was a good soldier. I was vigilant. I didn't get tired spiritually. Or if I did, I spent more time with God to get re-energized. I never gave up. I kept at it." And that's what God wants. He is turning us into diamonds. Until that effort is completed, God working in us, we will perhaps reflect maybe some of the false values of society, but we're in a state of change. We have a lot of people that are overcoming different things, and some of the problems that exist now never existed 20 and 30 years ago, especially with the advent of internet. But there have always been different challenges. That's not the end of the world. Our response may or may not be the end of the world. Are we good soldiers? We have to fight. And as I mentioned, sometimes people would want to check out and say, "Well, I'm taking no position. I'm not getting involved." Even if we try to hide, trouble can come our way. Or persecution can come our way. Challenges will come our way. God will let them come our way. In Revelation 12, in verse 7, Revelation 12 and verse 7, we see again how warfare is one of the themes of the Bible, spiritual warfare. In verse 7, Revelation 12, "And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And Satan the great was cast out." Verse 9. And then we go down to verse 17, and it says the dragon was angry with the woman. The woman is representative of the church, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and the testimony of Jesus Christ. Let's think about that. We're at the end of the age. If we keep the commandments of God, we're on a collision course with Satan. He's at war with the church. He hates the church. He hates the idea that God can create puny human beings that will end up replacing him. In his perverted thinking, he still thinks he can win, that it's worth fighting. War is worth waging against God and the remnant of God's seed. And so it is that we're inevitably involved. When you think of the different stages of God's plan of salvation, represented by Pentecost or Day of Trumpets, or the binding up of Satan on the Day of Atonement, or the Feast of Tabernacles, isn't it amazing how much violence is associated with the Holy Days? When the Israelites came out of Egypt, Pharaoh wanted to destroy them. And you read in Exodus, in the subsequent trials that happened, that threatened, attacked by the Midianites. There were all kinds of people with the name Ites at the end that were after them. And they trusted in God, at least a few of the leaders did. But wow, what a toll. Most of the Israelites didn't make it. And they were spiritual casualties. Now God will bring them up again in the second resurrection because he didn't understand what they were doing. But wow, even some of the martyrdoms like James in Acts 12 occurred around the days of unleavened bread. When Christ went up in John 7 to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, he knew that he was risking his life to keep the feast. That's something that bothers me sometimes when somebody says, "Well, I could go to the feast. My family will take me. They'll pay the whole thing. I can put out there on a silver platter, but I can't see going." Well, if health really interfered, then maybe not. You counsel with your pastor on that. But But sometimes people lose their enthusiasm and the will to obey God completely. We need each other. We need that support. We need to help others and encourage others to be good soldiers. Different violent events have happened, picturing holy days, but Christ risked his life to keep Feast of Tabernacles. Read about that in John 7. That was quite a commitment. And then if we think to other times, Day of Trumpets pictures Christ coming on the back to the earth, and will he be met with a bunch of cheering, happy people that are glad to receive him? No, they'll make war with him. The first time I read that, I was absolutely dumbfounded. I thought that everybody would be happy. I didn't know the Bible. I didn't understand. These people are deceived. They're an extension of Satan's angry mind. Satan hates to see human beings replace himself. Angels are above humans. Man was created a little lower than the angels. In 1 Corinthians 6, it says we'll be judging angels. That would put Satan in a subservient position, and he's too proud to accept that, so he fights against that. And so even if we don't want war, war will find us. Spiritual battles. But if we're close to God, we will win. It's nothing to fear unless we get lackadaisical and Laodicean. I see so many groups out there labeling others as Laodicean, and some people wonder our way and so forth. I don't think so, but the best thing is, I don't know, I can't control or think about what other people are doing. I just know I don't want to be lukewarm if I can help it, if I can. I'm not going to assume that I am or I'm not. I'm not going to assume anything. I'm going to try to anticipate that the future will be maybe more challenging than the past. As we get closer, like a woman giving birth, you get stronger and stronger birth pangs. And we have to be vigilant. We've got to be soldiers. And you never know when a birth pang is coming. We had one about 7 years ago, 6 years ago. Florida was a war zone during that time. We've had crisis in 74. 72 was kind of a crisis with Mr. Armstrong's son. The implications of that. Always there's collateral damage with these things. But then damage because, well, to put without oversimplifying, people weren't good soldiers. They weren't observant. They weren't observant of the right things, which is, am I doing what I can to maintain a relationship with God? I can evaluate anybody else, but that doesn't help me. What am I doing? So let me summarize. We are to be good soldiers, yes. We have to be vigilant and be willing to call in backup. We can't do this by ourselves. If we try to, we're more outgunned and outmanaged than the LA Police Department back in 1997 in North Hollywood. We don't want to go there. We don't want to be that vulnerable. If we can have God's help, his blessing, his inspiration in our lives, to have the spiritual eyesight, to be close to him, to say no to wrong thoughts, wrong pulls, wrong ideas, wrong attitudes projected by Satan, who fires the fiery darts that can sometimes easily beset us if we're not careful. I remind us of Ephesians 6 and the tools of warfare. This is a huge subject. It's impossible to cover everything on spiritual warfare in one sermon. But to fight against Satan, we have to put on the armor of faith and the helmet of salvation. And all that armor is in front of the body. There's not no consideration for army behind, because God doesn't expect us to turn tail and run and expose our backside. Putting on spiritual armor is vital. And the best spiritual armor, of course, is contact with God. It's a simple strategy, but it is one that we can take for granted and overlook, especially if we're already doing it. We have to do it with enthusiasm. It has to be fresh perspective. We have to be animated about it, at least inwardly. We don't have to shout and scream, but we have to have an inward desire to be the soldiers of Jesus Christ. So I'm sure we will be. You've successfully done that up till now, but it's one day at a time. If we want to approve the opportunity for us to be here tomorrow, next week, and all. We keep moving ahead with these wonderful tools of salvation.